December 1993. A gunman opens fire on a Long Island railroad car packed with commuters.
Everybody's running crazy. I see blood all over.
The nation is transfixed when the accused shooter acts as his own attorney.
This is a case of stereotype victimization of a black man.
Are these the words of a madman? Or a calculating killer's finest performance?
He had cast himself in a leading role, which nobody had anticipated.
December 7th, 1993. Robert Giuliano is on his daily commute home from work in New York City to Long Island.
Got on the train, headed out of Penn Station on the 533 to Mineola, which I take to Maryland Avenue. 14 years I had a business in the city, and that was my car. Third car, third seat. You met the same people every night. I may not have known them intimately or personally. Because you know what? 6 o'clock at night, you don't want to be talking to anybody after a hard day's work. You just want to sit there on a train, you read your paper, and that's how it was. It was very peaceful for everybody. Everybody had their places on that train. Everybody had their place, and it was nice. Until it was disrupted. We got to Jamaica Station. And I remember this woman, young girl came on. Beautiful, angelic face, very pretty girl. And she said, is this seat taken? I said, no. Started going.
The train pulls out of Jamaica Station and heads towards Mineola.
We get to New Hyde Park, and at that point I get up. I have a briefcase and I wait by the door for the next stop. As soon as the door closes, I hear shooting. I was in a maze. Is this a movie? I'm looking down this. I see blood all over. Everybody's running crazy.
Over the next 3 minutes, the man shoots 25 people. Robert Giuliano is one of them.
So they're gone, I went like this. One went over my head, and one went through my arm into my chest. I didn't know I was shot. I didn't feel the pain, I didn't feel the sting, nothing like that. I looked around and thought I was being tackled. Nobody there. At that point, it got quiet. There was no more shooting. And I started gasping for air, not wondering what the hell's going on. And I got up and my chest was expanded. I said, what the? And I couldn't breathe. And at that point, that's when they jumped him.
Paramedics and police rush to the Maryland Avenue station. Assistant District Attorney George Peck is also called to the scene.
I got a call from the police department shortly after the train arrived at Maryland Avenue, and I went to the scene, and the scene was one bloody mess.
Meanwhile, 47-year-old Joyce Guricki is expecting her husband James to arrive home from work at any moment. But that night, he's late.
He was like an angel. Everybody loved him. He was just one of the nicest people you could ever meet. My neighbor told my daughter that there was a shooting at the station in Garden City. Sure enough, everything was all over the TV. And I just was horrified by what was going on. So I really was getting very worried. So around 10:30, the doorbell rang. I opened the door, and the two detectives were there. And I said, he got killed, didn't he? And they said, yes. And with that, I fell to the floor.
James Garricky, two other men and two young women were dead. Another young woman died at the hospital soon afterwards. She was the sixth victim. 19 others were wounded. For the survivors, this would be just the beginning of their ordeal. The man who passengers had tackled is 35-year-old Colin Ferguson, a well-educated immigrant from a wealthy Jamaican family. He had been caught, literally, with a smoking gun. In his pockets, police find handwritten notes entitled "Reasons for This," which suggest the attack was racially motivated. At first glance, it looks like an open and shut case.
You had eyewitnesses. You had the weapon. You had the notes. And we had people who arrested him at the scene. You can't get any stronger case than that.
But in fact, it's not going to be a straightforward case at all. Despite everything, Ferguson claims an unidentified white man was the real killer and that he had escaped. With a train full of witnesses, Ferguson is clearly delusional or a liar. He insists he is perfectly sane, but his court-appointed attorney thinks differently. He announces that despite Ferguson's claims, he will pursue a verdict of not guilty by reason of insanity. But Ferguson rejects the plea and refuses to cooperate. Instead, he talks to leading civil rights attorney Ronald Kuby, who has a track record of successfully defending difficult cases.
We had just been following the case in the media, and then after a month or two had gone by, and there had been much more explication about racism and about Colin Ferguson's claims of racism, statements about race, his specific stated desire to kill white people. It was at that point that he contacted our office.
Kuby and his partner, William Kunstler, agree to take Ferguson's case and begin to formulate their defense. Although they agree with Ferguson's public defender that their client is insane, they take a different approach, one that is grounded in Ferguson's past. Colin Ferguson was born in Jamaica, the son of a wealthy businessman. He graduated from high school in the top third of his class. In his 20s, he moved to the United States, but found he was only offered menial jobs. He began to feel a burning sense of injustice.
For the first time, he began to encounter systematic institutionalized racism in the United States. Didn't encounter it in Jamaica, had grown up thinking that he was no different than anybody else, and soon got to the United States and learned differently. Clearly, the exposure to systematic racism, the corrosive effect of racism, helped inform and form his hatreds and sort of gave direction to his insanity.
Over the years, Ferguson gradually slid deeper into paranoia, becoming convinced that the world was conspiring against him. In the notes found on Ferguson, his rants about his sense of racial injustice gave Kuby and Kunstler their strategy for his defense.
That's really when Kunstler began to think about this as not just a case of a killer or a terrorist, but really a case involving somebody whose psyche was so battered and corroded by racism in the United States that he finally just snapped. We didn't claim that Colin was sane. we were claiming that because of his delusional, paranoid state, he was not criminally responsible. He was not guilty by reason of insanity. But the form the insanity took was what we deemed to be black rage.
Initially, Ferguson is supportive of Kuby's black rage defense, even though it relies on the assumption that he is guilty and insane. In the meantime, prosecutor George Peck prepares to argue the opposite, that at the time of the shooting, Ferguson was not criminally insane. To prove it, he must demonstrate that Ferguson knew what he was doing and that he knew what he was doing was wrong. For Peck's prosecution, Ferguson's notes are equally important, as they suggest he had carefully planned the attack. They also clearly explain that he didn't choose New York City as the venue due to Ferguson's respect for David Dinkins, New York's first black mayor. Ferguson had sat on the train and waited until they crossed into Nassau County before he opened fire.
This is obviously an indication by Ferguson that he doesn't want to embarrass Dinkins. And if you don't want to embarrass someone, you know what you're doing is wrong.
What's more, ballistics reveal that Ferguson used controversial black Talon bullets designed to expand on impact and cause maximum damage. It's another indication that Ferguson knew exactly what he was doing.
The witnesses testified that Colin Ferguson went up and down the train saying, "You're going to get it. You're next." He knew he had a gun. He knew he was firing a gun. And when he was subdued by the three civilians, he shouted out, "A terrible thing has happened here today." A truly insane person couldn't care when he committed a crime because he thinks it's right.
The stage is set for a trial that will ask whether Ferguson was driven mad by racial discrimination to the point that he was not responsible for his actions. Or is he a calculating killer? But 5 months after choosing Kuby as his attorney, Ferguson rejects the black rage defense. He again insists he is innocent and then accuses his own counsel of being part of the conspiracy against him. Kuby remains convinced Ferguson is insane, too crazy even to recognize that insanity is his only real defense.
And the irony is, everybody who pleads not guilty by reason of insanity is at least sane enough at the time they enter their plea to know that their best defense is to be crazy, which of course bespeaks a certain degree of rationality. Conversely, the craziest people in the world are the ones who insist that there's nothing wrong with them. It's everybody else who has the problem. And Colin was very, very much in that category.
Under New York law, a defendant must be sane enough to assist in his own defense if there is to be a trial. With Ferguson rejecting what Kuby thinks is his only defense, he demands the court re-examine Ferguson's competency. If the judge rules Ferguson is incompetent, there won't be a trial at all.
There wasn't a lot of difference between the two sides in terms of the psychiatric evaluation. But for the standards of competence, all you have to do is to be able to understand the nature of the proceedings and assist in your own defense in the most rudimentary way. So in essence, if you know the difference between a judge and a grapefruit, you're competent to stand trial.
On December the 10th, 1994, the judge is ready to deliver his decision. He again rules that Ferguson is competent to stand trial. Then Ferguson makes a move that stuns everyone. Against all advice, he fires Kuby and says he will defend himself.
Once you're competent to make these decisions in the legal system, you can make all the decisions that a lawyer would ordinarily make for you. And that's what Colin wanted, and that's what Colin got. It's going to be mental illness theater. It's going to be all of us sucked into Colin Ferguson's own delusional behavior with the aid of the prosecutor.
On January the 26th, 1995, the trial begins at Nassau County Court. What would follow is probably one of the most bizarre courtroom spectacles anyone had ever seen. In his opening statement, Ferguson, referring to himself in the third person, denies being the shooter.
The evidence will show that Colin Ferguson was in fact a well-meaning passenger on the train. And also a well-meaning passenger transporting to safe haven a firearm, which in fact he purchased legally. This is a case of stereotype victimization of a black man and subsequent conspiracy to destroy him.
He was a very intelligent individual.
What's the sense of people pointing fingers when there are inconsistencies in their police statements and their grand jury statements? Who do you believe?
I don't know what he was reading, but for someone who's never been in a courtroom before, he was comfortable.
Ferguson takes on the demeanor of a seasoned defense attorney. Many believe he is mimicking the mannerisms of prosecutor George Peck.
Someone opened the bag, took the weapon out of the bag, and proceeded to shoot. It is at that point that Mr. Ferguson was awakened by the gunfire and himself, amidst the confusion, sought to protect himself, sought to run for cover like any other person on that train.
You had a man who looked like a lawyer, sounded like a lawyer, but this was a crazy person and doing a superb job of acting, which put the judge and the prosecutor in the position of really being supporting players in Colin Ferguson's mental illness reenactment. What became clear to us was that Colin was not only participating in this theater piece of a trial. He had cast himself in a leading role, which nobody had anticipated.
As Ferguson continues, his delusions become more and more apparent.
There were 93 counts to that indictment. 93 counts only because it matches the year 1993. Had it been 1925, it would have been 25 counts.
Like so many people who are delusional, they see tremendous significance in specific facts that really don't appear to be related to each other to regular people.
As the bizarre spectacle plays out, the debate rages across the country about whether it should have been allowed to happen.
Ferguson was found competent, and therefore you can't force a lawyer on somebody.
No matter what defense we used or didn't use, no matter what lawyer he had or didn't have, he was always going to do this. He was always going to represent himself. This was his shot at greatness.
For the survivors, Ferguson's performance in court is difficult to watch. But their greatest challenge is yet to come. A week into the trial, passenger Robert Giuliano begins to tell the jury the gruesome details of what he saw that evening on the train.
Pointing to the left, pointing to the right, walked up a few feet, pointed in this whoever was in front of me just went like this, random. I remember these two girls that took the train. I used to call them the Blonde Sisters, and I just said, "He's got a gun, get down." And I pushed them down and just get down. And I heard it get quiet. I saw the breech come back, the gun was empty, went back in the seat. So I put another clip in. Picked up the gun and started shooting again. At that point, pretty much everybody was either shot, injured. I couldn't tell. This girl who was sitting next to me, she got up and started crawling, and she didn't know where the shooting was coming from ricocheting and what have you. You couldn't tell, and I looked up. He was getting closer and closer, and I'm yelling at him. I'm yelling, "No, no, not that way," or something in that order. Before you know it, he was about 10 feet away, and she picked her head up, and he looked at her, and he pointed and shot her. Looked like a head exploded. I found out it was in her neck, and the blood was just, it just went all over me. I would have done something, but I couldn't. It really bothered me. That was one of the hardest things to get through. And it took me a long time to get over that, not being able to control that situation.
He looked me in the eyes, square in the face. I'm looking at you right now. And he pointed his gun at me.
Almost all of those wounded in the attack testify against Ferguson.
He looked me dead in the eye and pointed the gun, and with the most serious look I have ever seen on anyone's face, he shot me in the chest.
Worst of all, the survivors must face being cross-examined by the very person they saw shoot them.
They, I think, gathered strength from each other, and for the most part, they couldn't wait to face him.
I watched you reach over the top of one seat with your right hand and shoot down into it.
I saw you shooting everyone on the train, okay?
Marianne Phillips, the first person to be shot, played dead to avoid being shot again. Ferguson tries to argue that that means she couldn't have seen him.
The only time you have seen the suspect is on TV. Am I correct?
I saw you shoot me, and I've seen you on TV.
I was one of the last to be questioned. And I stood out. I'm like, "I'm looking at you right now," for 32 minutes. Never took my eyes off him. I pulled everything I had inside of me, got all my strength up, and I said, "This guy's not going to beat me again."
Is it your testimony that the defendant Ferguson stood right in front of you and shot you?
You weren't right in front of me. You were about 10 to 12 feet away, approximately distance we're at about now.
But even in the face of so much evidence, Ferguson maintains the defendant is innocent. In a rambling closing argument, more than a year after he was first indicted, Ferguson accuses the many witnesses who testified against him of conspiring with the authorities to convict him. On February the 17th, 1995, Colin Ferguson is found guilty on multiple charges, including all six counts of murder. A month later, survivors and victims' family members file into court to testify during sentencing. For 3 days, those affected by the railroad massacre ask the judge to punish Ferguson as severely as possible. Joyce Gericke reads a letter written by her 11-year-old daughter.
"It feels so unreal. I still try to remember his voice. I wish my dad could see me graduate. He still will from above, and I hope he is proud."
When I was doing my impact statement, everybody was crying. You know, I got emotionally upset the way that he wouldn't even look at me when I was doing this.
"I will never understand for the rest of my life why you, Colin Ferguson, murdered my husband. Don't you ever get a chance to destroy anybody else's life like you did to all these other people."
Robert Giuliano, also takes the stand.
I witnessed Colin Ferguson murder Maria McToto, whose blood was spilled on my clothes. She didn't have a chance.
Still, throughout the victim's statements, Ferguson seems to be barely listening.
You remember these eyes? They must have been a piece of garbage! You're a goddamn animal! 5 minutes, that's all I need with you, 5 minutes!
During the trial, the death sentence had been reinstated in New York for murder. But Ferguson would not face execution. His crimes had occurred before the law was passed. Instead, Colin Ferguson is sentenced to more than 300 years in jail.
You, Colin Ferguson, will never again return to society, but rather will spend the rest of your natural life in prison.
He went away for life, 300 some odd years, for the rest of his life. 23 hours a day in a 6x8 jail cell. He's only allowed out 1 hour a day. I went into a room after that in my office and sat in the room and looked around. And I said, okay, I accept it. I'd rather be dead before I do that.
A summer's night in Paris turns horrific when a beautiful young woman is found raped and murdered. A serial killer is on the loose.
Tous les parents des victimes là vont avoir la vision, l'écoute d'horreur.
Can new, untested forensic science catch the psychopath before more women die and bring the beast of the Bastille to justice? After a late night out in July of 1995, 27-year-old Hélène Frinking heads home to her apartment in central Paris. Her body is discovered the next day.
Cette jeune femme a été violée et assassinée.
Right away, police notice the killer's ominous signature. Hélène Frinking's bra had been cut between the cups and her knickers at the side. The way she was bound and the ferocity of the 16 stab wounds bear a strong resemblance to two other violent sexual crimes under investigation by Paris police.
On découvre du sperme et l'analyse de ce sperme permet d'établir un code génétique. C'est le même profil génétique.
With a DNA match to the previous two victims, Paris police now know they are looking for a serial killer. The two other victims were 33-year-old Agnès Nichecomp, who was raped and murdered in December 1994, and 23-year-old Elizabeth Ortega, who was attacked at knife point only 3 weeks before Hélène Frinking's murder. Miraculously, Elizabeth survived the attack.
Cette jeune femme qui s'appelait Elizabeth Ortega, la jeune femme a réussi à se défaire de ses liens et à sauter par la fenêtre et à échapper au tueur.
Investigating magistrate Judge Gilbert Thiel takes the lead on all three cases linked by DNA. But these three are not the only beautiful young women to have been attacked recently in Paris. Judge Thiel is also given two additional cases, 28-year-old Catherine Rocher and 23-year-old Elsa Benadi. These two victims were raped and murdered in 1994, but not in their apartments. They were attacked in underground car parks. Still, police have a gut instinct that all five cases are connected.
Ma collègue me dit, il n'y a rien qui rattache cette affaire, ces deux affaires-là, à l'affaire où on dispose d'ADN. Mais elle me dit, néanmoins, je pense que c'est peut-être le même auteur.
Catherine Rocher and Elsa Benhadi had been killed in their cars, but their throats had been slashed with a knife. And they had also had their underwear cut in the same manner as the apartment murder victims. And in Elsa Benhadi's car, police had found drops of blood on a leaflet, which they sent for forensic analysis.
En termes de traces pour ces crimes, il y avait peu de choses. Il y avait juste un prospectus sur lequel il y avait une tache de sang qui avait été retrouvée, et on ne savait pas si c'était vraiment lié au meurtre. Toujours est-il qu'on a extrait un profil génétique de cette tache de sang.
Police now have two genetic fingerprints. One for the apartment murderer and one for the car park killer. But incredibly, authorities never compare the two DNA profiles, and two separate teams handle the investigations. For the next few weeks, both of them continue to look for a suspect. Then on September the 19th, 1995, the car park killer team comes up with a name.
Ils avaient analysé dans la France entière tous les gens qui pouvaient avoir le même mode opératoire. Et ils s'étaient aperçus qu'il y avait un certain Guy Georges qui avait été condamné pour avoir agressé une jeune femme dans un parking.
Guy Georges is a 32-year-old vagrant with a troubled past. As a baby, he was abandoned by his single mother. His grandparents refused to care for him, so he was brought up by professional foster mother, Madame Morin. But when he was 14, he tried to strangle her special needs adopted daughter, Rosaline. Before he turned 17, Georges was jailed for attacking two other women. And most alarming of all, as an adult, he has graduated to sexual assault and rape, attacking three women in their apartments and one in a car park. Now back in prison for the latest sex offense, Georges seems the obvious suspect for both recent crime sprees.
Donc ils ont extrait Guy Georges de sa prison, ils l'ont amené à la brigade criminelle de Paris, ils l'ont interrogé, il n'a pas reconnu être l'auteur des faits, et ils lui ont fait une prise de sang pour faire une empreinte génétique.
The results of the genetic profiling are stunning. Guy Georges' DNA does not match the blood on the leaflet found in the back of Elsa Benhadi's car. He is eliminated as a suspect in the car park killer investigation and handed over to the apartment murder team. But somehow, Guy Georges' DNA isn't tested against their samples.
Mais à aucun moment on nous demande de comparer l'ADN de Guy Georges avec l'autre ADN, celui du tueur qui opérait dans les appartements.
Police do question Guy Georges about the apartment murders, but he denies any involvement. They also show his photo to Elizabeth Ortega, the victim who escaped out of her apartment window, but she doesn't recognize him. Police conclude Guy Georges is not their serial killer. He is sent back to prison to serve the remaining 2.5 years of his current sentence. And the killing spree stops.
Et il y a une chose qui nous frappe, c'est qu'il n'y a plus de crime. Or, on sait très bien qu'un tueur en série, il est incapable de s'arrêter. Il récidive plus ou moins à brève échéance, mais il récidive. On se dit peut-être qu'il est mort.
In June 1997, Guy Georges is released from prison. And in September, 19-year-old Magali Serotti is murdered in her Paris apartment.
Qu'on retrouve assassinée dans son appartement, égorgée, mais cette fois-ci, c'est pas au milieu de la nuit, ainsi qu'on avait pu l'établir pour les autres victimes assassinées dans un appartement. C'était en fin d'après-midi.
Police are stunned. They fear the serial killer is back. Although this time he leaves no DNA at the crime scene. But he soon strikes again.
À la fin novembre 1997, c'est une jeune femme de 26 ans qui, cette fois-ci, est assassinée après avoir elle aussi été préalablement violée. Il s'agit de Mademoiselle Estelle Malt, c'est son père qui va la découvrir dans son appartement.
Estelle had been stabbed in the neck. Her underwear was cut in the same way as all the other victims. And police find a blood-stained sweatshirt, which they send for forensic analysis.
On fait expertiser ce sang et là on s'aperçoit que c'est un mélange de deux sangs, celui de la victime qui a été égorgée, mais un autre sang. Et cet autre sang va se révéler être celui du serial killer numéro 1 qu'on a identifié dans les précédentes affaires d'assassinat de filles en appartement.
News that a serial killer is stalking Paris hits the press. The chief of police issues an official warning telling young women to be careful walking home at night in case they're followed. Panic spreads like wildfire across the city.
Et le juge-t-il, on ne peut plus continuer comme ça. Il y a une pression médiatique extrêmement importante à Paris. C'est une véritable psychose.
In desperation, Judge Thiel makes a bold move. He asks all the laboratories in France to search their genetic files to try and find a match to the serial killer's DNA. But Thiel's request is a huge invasion of privacy for the individuals who have their DNA stored on file. And it's also against French law. The labs refuse to comply.
Je dis à ces laboratoires de police scientifique, eh bien écoutez, je comprends votre position, mais vous allez me l'écrire et on en parlera à la prochaine victime.
The labs ask for more time to consider what to do.
Trois jours après, un des responsables de tous les laboratoires en France m'appelle et me dit, bah, finalement, monsieur le juge, on va faire ce que vous nous demandez.
In November 1997, French labs that store human DNA profiles start searching for the identity of the serial killer. Without any computer programs to run searches, each sample must be compared by hand. It takes 5 months, but on March the 24th, 1998, Dr. Olivier Pascal at the genetic laboratory of Nantes finds a match.
Je téléphone au juge Thiel en lui disant, monsieur le juge, j'ai deux nouvelles à vous apprendre, une bonne et une mauvaise. Il me dit, commencez par la bonne, je me doute quelle est la mauvaise nouvelle. Et je lui dis, on a identifié le tueur en série, c'est Guy Georges, mais la mauvaise nouvelle, c'est qu'on l'avait depuis 2 ans dans nos cartons, et que si on l'avait identifié avant, eh bien les deux dernières victimes seraient aujourd'hui vivantes.
It's a race against time to find Guy Georges before he kills again. Since he has no known address, police must search the entire city. On March the 26th, 2 days after he was confidentially identified, Guy Georges is still at large. But Judge Thiel's job is about to get even harder.
Et le 26 mars au matin, il y a une station de radio périphérique qui annonce qu'il est identifié, l'affaire a fui, et qui la station, une autre station de radio, dans la foulée, donne carrément son identité.
If Georges was listening to the radio, he would now know he's public enemy number one. Judge Thiel issues a warrant for his arrest and informs Border Control that Georges may try to flee the country. At 12:15 on March the 26th, Guy Georges is finally tracked down in Montmartre, central Paris, and arrested. When he's brought in front of Judge Thiel, he claims innocence.
Il me dit qu'il a rien fait. Je lui cite le nom de quelques-unes de ses victimes, Lestelle Malt, Hélène Frinkin, Elisabeth Ortega, Agnès Nischkampf. Là, il fait une syncope, il tombe en arrière, je le rattrape par le blouson.
Judge Thiel is sure Guy Georges is the man who attacked the women in the apartments. But Georges continues to deny any involvement. Then suddenly, he starts talking.
Et puis en deuxième partie de nuit, tout d'un coup, il se met à parler. Il se met à parler de l'affaire de Magali Sirotti. Et il reconnaît, alors que là, on n'a pas d'ADN disponible encore. Et il avoue, de manière circonstanciée.
His first confession opens the floodgates. Next, Guy Georges confesses to another case from 1991. 3 years before the most recent killing spree started, in which 19-year-old Pascal Escaffé was stabbed to death in her apartment. By the end of the night, he is charged with 5 murders of women in their apartments, plus the attempted murder of Elisabeth Ortega, who managed to escape. But Judge Thiel has a hunch there could be even more.
Il restait encore les assassinats des 2 filles dans les parkings, Catherine Rocher et Elsa Benadi, pour lesquelles on n'avait pas d'ADN et dont les dossiers étaient toujours distincts.
Guy Georges was eliminated from the car park investigation when his DNA didn't match blood spots found at one of the crime scenes. But that was before he'd confessed to being a serial killer. Now, he's asked again if he killed Catherine Rocher and Elsa Benadi. He maintains he did not, and is sent to jail to await trial. Then 8 months later, Judge Thiel decides to try one last time to question Guy Georges about the car park murders. He is interrogated for 10 hours. Finally, he starts to confess to the murder of car park victim number one, Catherine Rocher. Then something incredible happens. While describing the attack, he inadvertently describes the crime scene of victim number two, Elsa Benadi.
L'enquêteur lui a montré la photo du corps dénudé d'Elsa Benadi dans la voiture et il a dit là, oui, j'ai un flash, j'ai également tué cette jeune femme. Et après, il s'est enfermé dans un mutisme complet.
Police feel confident they have a solid case. But in fact, the fight is far from over. On March the 19th, 2001, Guy Georges arrives in court to stand trial for 1 count of attempted murder and 7 counts of murder. He is to be defended by 2 renowned lawyers, Frédéric Pont and Alex Ursulet. Despite all his confessions, the defense enters a plea of not guilty.
Moi, quand je l'ai rencontré, j'ai rencontré quelqu'un qui paraissait calme, sûr de lui et posé, et qui estimait que ce n'était pas lui et qu'il était injustement accusé.
Guy Georges' counsel believe they can put forward a strong defense. They intend to claim he can't be the killer because he wasn't recognized by Elizabeth Ortega, the victim who escaped. Secondly, they plan to undermine the fledgling science of DNA analysis and point to mistakes in procedure. Their client confidently agrees to have his DNA retested.
Nous avons dit, la preuve, l'élément fort contre vous, c'est cette expertise ADN, mais cette expertise, elle est critiquable, donc est-ce que vous êtes prêt à refaire une expertise ADN? Et lui disait, mais oui, bien sûr.
The prosecution opens the trial. Family members of the victims are in court to see the man they believe robbed them of their loved ones. They sit together, only meters from Guy Georges.
La confrontation dans la cour d'assises, qui est une salle magnifique, très grande, mais les parties sont assez rapprochées. Et donc la confrontation avec les parties civiles avait été très, très rude.
The families are scheduled to testify. But before any of them take the stand, the prosecution calls the defendant himself. Until now, he has appeared calm and in control. But under the spotlight of cross-examination, Georges starts to show his true nature.
Il y a eu l'avocat, un de mes confrères, qui lui a posé une question sur la manière dont il utilisait un couteau. Et là, au lieu de répondre, il a fait un geste de la main qui a statufié toute la cour d'assises parce qu'on a eu l'impression de le voir en action.
Guy Georges raises his hand in a violent gesture. The courtroom is shocked.
Ça a commencé à basculer. Et à partir de là, il s'est un peu mis en colère. Il a eu le sentiment d'être piégé. Il s'est braqué. Il est rentré en lui-même. Et il a commencé à ne plus répondre aux questions qui le mettaient en difficulté.
Guy Georges leaves the stand. But his confident persona has started to crumble. The prosecution begins calling the victims' families. Their testimony is harrowing, particularly that of Elsa Benadi's sister, Amélie.
Le témoignage qui a le plus touché, je crois, c'était la sœur d'une des victimes. Parce qu'elle a ressuscité pendant quelques instants sa sœur. Il n'y avait aucune violence de sa part, aucune haine. Il y avait une incommensurable peine.
Even defense lawyer Frédéric Pont is in tears when Amélie Benadi is testifying.
Je regardais Guy Georges regarder cette femme qui redonnait vie à sa sœur. Et j'ai été frappé de sentir chez lui la même émotion, l'insupportable émotion que tout le monde ressentait. C'est à l'occasion de ces audiences que Guy Georges a pris conscience de l'horreur des actes qu'il avait commis.
As witnesses to their client's obvious discomfort, the defense team starts to realize his story may be a lie. But more than that, they sense that Guy Georges is undergoing a psychological shift.
J'ai senti qu'il avait besoin d'avouer. Et j'ai senti aussi qu'il ne pouvait pas faire autrement pour la dignité des choses d'avouer.
Advocate Ursulé makes an extraordinary decision to help his client in a most unprecedented manner. He calls Guy Georges to the stand and talks him step by step through his confessions.
Et donc son avocat a énuméré chaque nom de victime. Guy Georges, reconnaissez-vous avoir tué mademoiselle Escarfaille? Oui, Reconnaissez-vous avoir tué et violé également préalablement Mademoiselle Rocher, oui, Mademoiselle Benadi, oui, Mademoiselle Nishkamp, oui, Mademoiselle Rinkin, oui, Mademoiselle Siroti, oui, et Mademoiselle Malde, oui. Et reconnaissez-vous avoir tenté de le faire sur la personne d'Elisabeth Ortega, oui, voilà.
It's the closure the victims' families have all been waiting for.
Et donc à partir de là, la pression est totalement tombée.
On the 5th of April 2001, Guy Georges is sentenced to life in prison with a minimum term of 22 years. Outside the courtroom, the relief is palpable.
Moi je suis sans haine, mais évidemment satisfait que l'assassin de ma fille ait pris le maximum dans le cadre de la loi actuelle.
De faire évacuer un peu cette haine que j'avais en moi, qui me détruisait en définitive, parce que la haine c'est très destructeur, et que je vais pouvoir survivre mieux.
The trial of Guy Georges ushered in a major change in French law. Following his arrest in 1998, the government bypassed their strict privacy rules and sanctioned the creation of a DNA database for sexual offenders. It is still used to catch rapists and murderers today.